Hi there. It's time now for your friendly neighborhood economist, the show where you'll hear what's going on with the economy locally, nationally, and internationally, explained to you in plain English. Promise. Hi there. This edition of your friendly neighborhood economist, show number 9, marks the beginning of our new improved schedule, now with 100% more shows per month. This is an experiment, so we'll see how it goes. My one or two regular listeners will remember that I had difficulty doing one show a month last year, so now we're up to 2, so we'll see. Anyway, in this show, we'll discuss the latest economic news and then look at some highlights in a little more detail. We'll talk about the upcoming sequester, school finances, and some about Governor Cuomo's budget proposal. Before we begin, I'd like just to take a moment to remember Terry Doyle, host of Imprint and a member of WGXC, as well as another community station, WIOX 91.3 FM in Roxbury. I only met him once, but he seemed like a good man to me. He showed my better half, Cheryl Kay, and I around the studio of the station in Roxbury. I know that he was an important part of both stations and that he will be missed. And now, the news. First, energy and environment news. There's some good news on this front. The town of Stuyvesant's hydroelectric plant is up and running again after almost 20 years and producing power. Small-scale hydroelectric power may be an important part of our future energy production and can potentially be done in a way that is not too disruptive for wildlife. In some not-so-great news, the Daily Mail passed along an AP story that reads like it came from a fracking industry press release. It tells us all about the billions of dollars landowners are getting from fracking licenses around the country. There is, of course, no doubt that landowners are getting paid. Of course, the doubt in many people's mind is about what the costs are and whether the benefits outweigh the costs. Unfortunately, the story did not contain anything about those costs. Health impacts are among those costs, and the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation is overdue to release findings about the possible health impacts of fracking on communities in New York. One of the outside reviewers chosen by the DEC, UCLA professor Richard Jackson, in an online seminar in January, suggested that a nationwide in-depth study of the health impacts of fracking is overdue and necessary, since one has not been done. There are also reports that his review has been back with DEC for over 2 months, along with the other two. This might make one wonder why Health Department Commissioner Nirav Shah says they need more time to complete their review. More time for what? Meanwhile, in Hudson, the Common Council voted to oppose the, quote, drilling, storage, and dispersal of hydrofracking fluids. Mayor Hallenbeck followed this up with an executive order preventing the wastewater treatment plant from accepting fracking wastewater and the Public Works Department from using it on the streets. As you may know, fracking wastewater is sometimes thought of as an appropriate thing to use to clear streets when it snows. Premier Brands news now. The acquisition of the old Walmart store in Greenport by Premier Brands will go forward as the Columbia County Industrial Development Authority reached an agreement that includes some but not all of the tax breaks Premier Brands was asking for. Specifically, the payment in lieu of taxes, pilot for short, was not approved. This would have allowed Premier to pay a fixed amount for property taxes for 5 years, possibly a very steep discount. But the company did get $33,000 in tax breaks on sales and mortgage taxes on the purchase and renovations that they'll be doing. Initial plans to use the front of the old store for retail space have been changed to use it for packaging magazines instead. Employment projections for the operation are 50 people when it's up and running fully, and seems like a good use of that abandoned property for sure. Now housing news. A number of stories about housing came up this month. First, some relatively good news. The housing market, that is the market for buying and selling places to live, seems to be recovering finally from the crash that it suffered beginning in 2006. The lead on this story from Politics on the Hudson is that New York State sales are up 9.5% in January over the previous year. The story includes a link to a document with details about year-on-year changes in sales prices, etc., for January, also broken down by county. In Columbia County, sales were flat, but the median price was 22% higher and unsold inventory was 30% lower than last January. Good news for people trying to sell their homes. For Greene County, sales were up, but the median price was 20% lower, although the inventory was also 27% lower than last January. Overall, this is further confirmation that the housing market is returning to historical trends, with the local area still lagging behind, but doing slightly better than last year on balance. This is good news not just for people looking to sell their homes and real estate agents, but also for construction workers who should be getting more work as the inventory of existing homes decreases and new home starts should increase. Of course, many homeowners in New York have seen the value of their homes shrink, even as they may have lost their jobs due to the recession, undermining their ability to pay their mortgages. I'm going to end the show today with a clip from the Young Turks that will serve to fuel anyone's rage regarding the banks and the housing market. But for now, let me just tell you that this past month, New York's Attorney General Eric Schneiderman reported on the disposition of about $1.8 billion in mortgage relief from a national settlement that New York participated in, with mortgage lenders involved in the housing crash. Any relief for people with mortgages they were defrauded into entering is certainly welcome, but frankly, $1.8 billion seems like a drop in the bucket in terms of what's needed in this state. Also this last month, Stephanie Lane, executive director of the nonprofit Housing Resources of Columbia County, Incorporated, gave a speech to the Rotary Club of Hudson in which she described the types of services HRCC provides, including improving housing conditions and access to housing for Columbia County residents, things like renovations that are needed that people can't afford, etc. In addition, they're acting as agents for the state government providing mortgage assistance. And that's the news. Now let's talk about school finances. First, a word about school finances in general. We talked last year about municipal finance, which is how cities and towns take in and spend money to provide services. I mentioned then that school districts are separate government entities with their own separate financing. So let me break that down for you. School districts rarely exactly match the cities or towns that they serve in terms of geography. New York City is an important exception since there is one school district for the whole city, but that's an exception. In our listening area, for example, the Hudson School District includes all of the city of Hudson and much of the surrounding towns. Just to the south of Hudson, near where I live, is the line where the Red Hook and Hudson School Districts meet. That line runs through the middle of Livingston. So the school districts are distinct government units for practical reasons. It's much easier to create a special district than try to get several towns to coordinate finances and agree about things like curriculum, etc. Water and sanitation services are organized in similar ways in many areas for different reasons. So homeowners around here have two separate property tax bills, one for the town that they live in, which goes to the services I discussed in my Happy Fun Time Municipal Finance show, and one for the school district that they live in. And a lot of the revenue for school districts comes from those tax payments. But there are two other important sources of school district revenues, the state government and the federal government. For example, Columbia and Greene County school districts get about 55% of their revenues locally from property tax payments, 39% from the state, mostly state aid, but also money from the STAR program, and about 6% from federal aid. That money, all of it, goes towards all the operating expenses of the school district, from salaries and benefits, to school buses, to pencils and paper. And in 2011, Columbia and Greene County School District spent about $20,000 per pupil per year to educate students. Now, school districts throughout the listening area are facing budget problems throughout the state as well, as a meeting of representatives from 47 districts from New York State revealed over the past month. This was reported in the Register Star. Now, the Star reported that part of the problem is that teacher pension payments are going to rise 37% next year due to a combination of two things: increased baby boomer retirees and low returns for the pension system since the 2008 financial crisis. Remember that? Thanks again, banks. Another problem, of course, is that state aid to districts has decreased over the last several years. Add to this the fact that the bottom of the fiscal food chain, property owners, are resistant to large increases in their property tax bills, and you get a crisis. But between 2009 and 2011, Columbia and Greene County school districts have seen their state aid decrease by $7.4 and $5.9 million, respectively. And that's about 10.5% and 9.5%, respectively. So the money they're getting from the state has decreased in the last couple of years by 10%. Districts have made up the difference, mostly with increased tax revenues, for a total of $6.6 and $4 million for Columbia and Greene County, respectively, which makes up about 89% and 69% of the lost state aid, respectively. Both counties also received increases in federal aid, $4.4 and $2 million, respectively, but that alone wasn't enough to make up for the shortfall in state aid. Teacher retirements did increase in the period by $416,000 and $595,000 respectively, but the largest increase in expenses was in health benefits, which increased $3.4 million and $1.6 million in Columbia and Greene County districts respectively. Now, this wasn't mentioned in the article. I'm not sure why. Teacher salaries took the biggest hit in Columbia County, dropping by 10%, while in Greene County districts, teacher salaries remained about the same, not really increasing, but they didn't drop by 10%. Now, healthcare is an issue that I'll be covering in upcoming shows, and this number tells you why it's so important. Health benefits for employees were 14.8% and 11% of school district expenses in Columbia and Greene County in 2011, and that's up 1% each since 2009, and they're only going to be higher this year and the next. And you can't blame the Affordable Care Act, since it isn't going to go into effect until next year for the most part. So there are a number of pressures coming in on school districts in terms of finances. First, lower revenues from state aid. This is due to lower revenues for the state, which is due to the recession. Second, skyrocketing healthcare costs, which is due to our out-of-control healthcare system. More on that in the coming shows. And third, pension payments are increasing because of the damage done by banks in the financial crisis. Let's talk now about the sequester. This is not completely a rehash of the fiscal cliff scam from December, just one part of it. To understand how we got to the sequester, though, we need to have a little history lesson. Come back with me to 1917, when Congress passed the Second Liberty Bond Bill to help pay for U.S. involvement in the First World War. A part of that bill set an upper limit on the amount of debt the U.S. government could have outstanding. In other words, it set a limit on how much the government could borrow. Of course, governments in general are always borrowing to fund budget deficits. You'll remember that that is just the amount by which government spending exceeds revenues. So since 1917, Congress has periodically raised the debt ceiling without any fuss or fanfare, including 18 times under the sainted President Reagan, 8 times under Clinton, and 7 times under Bush the Younger. It was pretty routine until 2011, when the House Republicans, under pressure from many Tea Party Republicans that had been elected in the midterm elections, decided that they would rather not increase the debt ceiling unless there were some big cuts in government spending. Now, I'm going to let Mark Fiore describe to you just how ludicrous that is.
Are you up to your ears in debt? Do the bills just keep coming? Get your financial house in order by refusing to pay. Debt Be Gone lets you take control of your financial future by not paying your bills of the past. Sure, some might call it defaulting, but Debt Be Gone is really a fiscal responsibility tool developed by the accounting wizards at Republicon Incorporated. Bought too much home entertainment on credit? Do the responsible thing and refuse to pay. Car payments out of hand? Stop paying them to show you won't stand for your fiscal irresponsibility. Ate a few too many lobsters with your steak? Just don't pay. Remember, you're today's fiscal conservative.
I'll gladly not pay you Tuesday for a hamburger today.
And take charge of your future bar tabs by not paying for your previous 17 beers. You don't have a drinking problem, you have a debt problem. Remember, fiscal responsibility starts with not paying for what you've bought. Debt Be Gone also means you'll get the Bill Me Never Boehner, the perfect way to handle those pesky calls from bill collectors.
You purchased 58 Super Deluxe Flying Jet Fighters.
Go f*** yourself. Go f*** yourself.
Debt Be Gone by Republicon Incorporated, when you absolutely, positively have to blow up the economy to get your way.
I think that puts it in perspective pretty nicely. Now, that's just one of two major problems I have with this position of deciding to not raise the debt ceiling. First, as Mark Fiore told us, to refuse to increase the debt ceiling means that Congress is saying that it would not pay for spending it had already authorized. This is not responsible behavior, to say the least. Second, and worse, it meant that they were willing to let the United States government default on its debt, since some of the borrowing that they would prevent would go towards servicing the already existing debt. This would undermine confidence in U.S. government debt, which would have a variety of consequences, none of them good for the U.S. It would mean that it would become even more expensive for the U.S. to borrow money in the future. It would lead to a global financial crisis, since U.S. government debt has, for a long time, been considered the safest financial asset to hold, and the whole global financial system is built on that, until then, unshakable foundation. And oh, by the way, it's also unconstitutional. The 14th Amendment makes it illegal, unconstitutional, for the U.S. government not to pay its debts. Now, since Congress and the President could not reach an agreement, they agreed to try to reach an agreement later. And to make sure that they would stick to their word, they agreed that if they did not reach an agreement, by the end of 2012, across-the-board spending cuts would go into effect automatically. This was one part of the fiscal cliff, which you may remember from a previous show. The Bush tax cuts expiring was another major component, both of the fiscal cliff scam and of the increase in the government's debt over the last decade, of course. Interestingly, the debt ceiling was just raised again by the Republican-controlled Congress. The deal that prevented us from going over the so-called cliff pushed the sequester back until March 1st. The sequester is the part of that whole deal that said we're going to have across-the-board cuts. The across-the-board cuts are the sequester. That's this coming Friday as I'm talking to you, or as I'm talking to this microphone, I should say. So if there's no deal before Friday, federal government spending will be reduced, including $42.7 billion in defense cuts. That's a 7.9% cut. $28.7 billion in domestic discretionary cuts. That's a 5.3% cut. $9.9 billion in Medicare cuts. That's a 2% cut in Medicare benefits. $4 billion in other mandatory cuts. A 5.8% cut to non-defense programs and a 7.8% cut to mandatory defense programs. What consequences will this have for the U.S. economy? Well, estimates of the impact on the unemployment rate range from an increase of 0.25% to 1.5% increase in the unemployment rate, which is in a pretty wide range, but even the lower estimate would not be good. We'd be back above 8%. And, you know, if the higher estimate is right, we'd be back above 9%. The economy will grow slowly, at a slower rate than it otherwise would, by about 0.6%. So 0.6% less growth this year. Now, it may be that by Friday, a deal could be reached, putting off the sequester until next year. This could be the beginning of a new periodic political theater to go along with the debt ceiling theater. Every so often, we have a agreement to put off the sequester. Every so often we have an agreement to raise the debt ceiling. We should get rid of both of them and spend our time on more important things, in my opinion. Now, the idea underlying the deal that gave us the sequester is that the federal government has a problem with its finances. That seems like an easy case to make because of large annual deficits in the later part of Bush's term and Obama's first term. The case is being made over and over again that this tough fiscal situation means that people will need to sacrifice, which means that people will need to swallow Social Security and Medicare benefit cuts. So some people will need to sacrifice, the majority of people for whom those benefits are a defense against poverty when and if they're able to retire. These programs are condescendingly referred to as entitlements by our rulers these days, as though we haven't all been paying into these programs for all of our working lives. Take Lloyd Blankfein, CEO of Goldman Sachs, who made more than $16 million in 2011. He has the following wisdom for us. Quote, Social Security wasn't devised to be a system that supported you for a 30-year retirement after a 25-year career. So there will be things that, you know, the retirement age has to be changed, maybe some of the benefits have to be affected, maybe some of the inflation adjustments have to be revised. But in general, entitlements have to be slowed down and contained. Unquote. There are so many things wrong with this, but let me just point out that almost no one can retire after a 25-year career. The current Social Security retirement age is 67, and Medicare kicks in at 65. So that means that people retiring at that age to get the maximum benefit will have been working for 50 years, not 25. I'm sure Lloyd would be relieved to hear that these moochers have a much lower life expectancy than he and his friends who retire after a 25-year career do. So very few of them actually live to be 97 years old. But the more important point is, these programs are actually not currently contributing to our deficit. The Social Security system currently takes in more than it gives out every year by over $100 billion. Although over time, revenues from the payroll tax, which is the tax that comes out of your paycheck to fund Social Security, those tax payments will not be enough to pay out benefits because of the increasingly old population. But during the Reagan administration, a system was set up to take care of just that eventuality. The surpluses in the Social Security fund since the 80s have been lent to the Treasury, so there's a multi-trillion dollar trust fund to draw on. This may also eventually run out as well. If that happens, as it does under some assumptions about future developments, what happens then? Well, Social Security beneficiaries at that time would get only 75% of their promised benefits. So the argument about Social Security finances literally breaks down to the following. We have to reduce benefits now, or else we will have to reduce benefits later, maybe. It makes a ton of sense, right? I'll just wait for you to finish yelling at the radio. Done? Okay. Medicare also isn't broke. However, Medicare will be in deficit sooner because of increasing healthcare costs. Remember those? But those costs should be the target of policy, not the benefits Medicare provides for seniors. And Medicare is not causing budget deficits currently. So where does this huge deficit come from? Today's budget deficits are caused by 12 years of war that were never paid for, tax cuts in 2001 and 2003 that turned a federal government surplus into a federal government budget deficit, and of course the continuing economic fallout from a financial crisis brought about by systematic fraud in our banking system that remains unpunished to this day. Fraud that paid off nicely for people like Lloyd Blankfein, who is telling us that everyone but him should sacrifice so that we can get our fiscal house in order. Thanks for the advice, Lloyd. Governor Cuomo's budget.
The context for the governor's budget proposal is a projected $3.5 billion shortfall in fiscal year 2013 without any changes to current funding and expected revenue. This is from a total of about $132 billion in projected spending. The governor's proposal is actually for slightly higher spending overall, with increased revenues making up the balance of the shortfall. The largest chunk of the gap filler is an increase in federal grants of $2.4 billion for Hurricane Sandy relief, as well as funds for the Affordable Care Act provisions, but this is mostly offset by a $2 billion increase in federal operating funds for same. Now, State Comptroller Thomas DiNapoli calls the revenue projections in the budget proposal overly optimistic. He bases this judgment on the assumptions in the budget that employment will grow 1.3%, earnings will grow 4.6%, leading to a 6.6% increase in tax collections. It would certainly be nice to see numbers like that, but I am with the comptroller in calling these numbers slightly optimistic. Governor Cuomo's budget proposal certainly has gotten a lot of attention, and not all of it positive, to say the least. Here are the main points in the proposal. First, it sets local aid payments, called AIM payments, at this year's levels, so no increases there. He also proposes to step down the cap on increases in local Medicaid payments from the current 3% maximum per year to no increase at all after 2 years. Also, there's apparently something in the plan to do with state pensions, creating a new lower tier of pensions that will help to lower costs for local governments. There has, I believe, been a bit of attention paid to this part of the proposal. I'll talk about that in a bit. New York State's school aid will increase by 4%. That's overall. It would be welcome news, given our earlier discussion of school finances. Unfortunately, the breakdown of the increase provided by the governor's office shows that Columbia County will receive just a 0.2% increase, and Greene County will receive just a 2.9% decrease over the latest numbers I have, which are from 2010. The decrease may be due to decreased enrollment, but those numbers are not provided in the budget. The governor proposes to leave the funding for SUNY and the Department of Environmental Conservation at last year's levels, but the budget does contain over $1 billion in new money for bridge and road repairs. About the Medicaid local payments cap, it's unclear to what extent this is an implicit commitment from the state to pick up the annual increases in Medicaid payments from now on. If there's no aid coming to local governments to pay increased Medicaid bills, it isn't at all clear what might happen. Does this mean that there will be a limit to the medical services localities will be able to provide under the Medicaid program? Or is it just assumed that the legislature will appropriate the necessary funds to cover the difference between the capped local payments and the actual costs? Not clear. Perhaps troubling. Now, on to pensions. I've talked about this over and over again, but let's lay out the details. State and local pensions are paid out of funds that are set up ahead of time so that contributions by the state or local government and or the state or local employees could grow over time through sound investments and so result in adequate resources to pay out the pensions earned during a working career when the worker retires. While to some extent the problems many pension funds face, both public and private, is the unplanned-for spike in retirements of the baby boomers, combined with increasing lifespans. However, the other problem with these funds is that they are dependent upon financiers to invest soundly. If that breaks down, funds can disappear quickly. And this happened during the housing bubble on a massive scale. Of course, not just pension funds were affected, but certainly they were, since many of them invested in these high-return, AAA-rated financial instruments called CDOs, or collateralized debt obligations. For those of you who haven't already heard this broken down, these were pieces of paper that represented a slice taken from a stack of mortgages, many of which were of highly risky nature, called subprime, and as it turns out, worthless, but some were of supposedly good quality, although quite a few that seemed good quality quickly became toxic, due to the collapse of the housing bubble and the collapse of housing prices. Ownership of one of these pieces of paper entitled you to a share of the mortgage payments generated by the mortgages in the stack. So as long as everybody was paying, everything was fine. But when people started to be unable to pay anymore, either because they lost their jobs because of the recession caused by the crash of the housing market and the financial crash that that brought on, or because the value of their home was lower than what they actually owed. When that happened, right, these pieces of paper became essentially worthless. So pension funds that had invested in these supposedly sound investments, remember, they were AAA rated, which is the highest rating that rating agencies give. So these supposedly sound investments go bad. So these pension funds find themselves in a really bad position, having lost a lot of their worth. Of course, since the financial crash that ensued took much of the value in the stock market along with it, the Dow is now only now reaching levels it was at in 2000. And the Fed has kept interest rates at basically zero to try to prevent a depression. Pension funds haven't been able to earn a decent return on anything anywhere. So that's the situation. Increasing numbers of people reaching retirement age and living a longer time after retirement, combined with a decade of losses or at best lack of growth by pension funds, and in some cases plain mismanagement also played a hand. So what is to be done? Who will pay for the mistakes so many financiers made? Why, of course, the workers who trusted in the bankers. So what is Governor Cuomo's solution to the present pension fund crisis? Well, it has two parts. First, it creates a new lower benefit pension tier for new state workers. Second, it allows municipalities to pay a fixed amount for the next 25 years, after which will be these new lower benefit retirees retiring, and voila, no more pension troubles. Before considering whether this plan is actually viable, let us note once again that the people being asked to sacrifice here are the workers. Some may object that state workers are getting benefits no one else is receiving, which, while true, begs the question why no one else is receiving them. Why shouldn't everyone get a decent pension? Just because a lot of people don't doesn't mean that everybody shouldn't. Moving on, though. The people paying the price, workers just now entering the workforce, are not the people who caused the mess, Wall Street financiers. The former will pay for the latter's huge bonuses with lower retirement security. Nice. Now, is the plan workable? Will it fix things? It isn't clear how the plan, which will lock in low payments now, will help the current crisis. After all, rising contribution rates is not the crisis. The poor state of pension funds is. And while this fixed payment plan will, you know, fix increasing contribution rates, it won't fix the state of pension funds. It'll actually make them worse, right? The fix being proposed seems designed to make the disease worse. In addition, how likely is it that the new lower-tier state and local workers will be unable to convince elected officials to improve promised benefits in the future? It doesn't seem all that likely to me and to a lot of other people. So it's not really clear whether Governor Cuomo's solution to the pension fund crisis is either fair or workable. What it does do is relieve pressure on local governments who are having a hard time funding their pensions right now, but it doesn't make the pension funds that they're having trouble funding any more sound, and it doesn't guarantee that there won't be problems in the future. It just kind of hopes that there won't. So it's not clear what good this plan will do, that supporting local governments to fully fund their pension funds won't. Of course, the latter costs money, while this plan doesn't.
Now, as I promised, here is Cenk Uygur of the Young Turks telling you about zombie titles, which will make your blood boil.
Since 2006, there have been about 10 million foreclosures, which is unbelievable. And everybody knows the pain of those foreclosures, and that's a huge problem in the country. Now, there was a second problem with those foreclosures. There was the robo-signing scandal, and the banks wound up having to pony up kind of $25 billion for it, because the reality is a lot of that is going to come from the U.S. taxpayer. But at least there was a settlement there, and of course they won't be charged with any of the crimes, even though it was criminal. So that was another huge problem. And in the robo-signing scandal, they would foreclose on houses they didn't even own, because they weren't checking the documents. They were just having robo-signatures on there. We foreclosed, we foreclosed, we foreclosed. Whether they should have foreclosed or not, whether it was even their mortgage or not, they would foreclose. And so we know about that tremendous injustice. Well, what's interesting is a third kind of injustice because of these foreclosures. There's 2 million houses that are still in foreclosure process but have not been foreclosed upon. Well, why is that? Well, it turns out there's this thing called a zombie title problem, where the banks tell you that they're going to foreclose on your house, and then they don't. Now, why do they do that, and what kind of trouble does that cause? Whew, now, wait till you get a load of the troubles. Number one, when they go to say that you have to leave the house, and they do, and the people leave the house, they don't realize they still have the title in their name. And if the bank changes their mind and decides not to foreclose on your house, for reasons I'll explain in a second, well, then you still have to keep paying the taxes. You have to make sure that your lawn and your house is in good shape. Otherwise, the county starts giving fees and penalties and fines, etc. And by the way, the bank keeps charging you, saying, hey, you know what? You still owe me that mortgage. You don't even realize you own the house because they never told you. It got so bad that in 3 different states recently, since nobody knew that they still owned the house because the bank had tricked them with the zombie title trick, the houses blew up. And you think, no, come on, really? Yes, you know why? Because they never turned off the gas. And so since they don't turn off the gas and nobody's in the house, the gas builds up, builds up, builds up, and in 3 different instances, at least, the houses have literally exploded. I mean, you want to talk about literal zombies, right? The houses become zombies in a sense. Now, wait till you get a sense of how horrible this injustice is and what they do to Americans here. So David Volker is one of the guys. He had a contractor business in Buffalo, New York, and his business ran into trouble during the recession. He couldn't make his payments, so HSBC said, we're foreclosing on your house. They literally placed a padlock on his door and put bank stickers all over the floor, and they said, you're done, you're foreclosed, get out of here, okay? They literally locked him out of his own house. So he was foreclosed. He went home. He went to his daughter's house and was living in the living room, I believe. And then they come back later and go, ha ha, we changed our minds. And it turns out you still own the house. And so you now owe all these taxes, all these liens, all these extra mortgages, and all the extra penalties that you have accrued. Well, Volker says, quote, I was stunned. I never for a moment thought I still owned this house. You know why? Because they padlocked the house and they told him he was foreclosed on. Now he goes and says, okay, look, HSBC, I have arranged the sale. It's just a short sale for this house. You are going to get the money. The bank says, no, we don't want to do it. You still owe us, and we're going to give it over to debt collectors, and we're still going to have the government hound you, okay? But we will not accept the sale. But then what in the world are you supposed to do? Okay, we're just getting warmed up. Now wait till you find out about the other people that this has afflicted. So let's go to Marlon Sheaf. He's a 55-year-old who used to drive trucks for Sara Lee. He did that for 25 years. He was recently sentenced to probation. Why? Because of the zombie titles. You're thinking, no, you can't. They can't arrest you for this. That doesn't make any sense. It does. Let me explain. So the county said, hey, listen, you got a tax lien, man. You technically own the house. They lied to you. That's your problem, not my problem. The bank told you you were foreclosed on like they do in every one of these cases. Sad day for you. You owe me this lien and you're not paying it. You owe me all these taxes for this house that you don't even live in, right? And then they give her over to a debt collector. Oh, here we go. Now here comes the trouble. So in his case, they said, we're charging you $4,185 for code violations. I'm going to charge you an extra $185 for court costs. And we'll even charge you $10,000 if the city is forced to tear down the house you don't live in and the bank told you was foreclosed upon. Okay? So that's a zombie title for you. So what's he going to do? They arrested him because once you owe the government money, they can arrest you. Now, it's actually a private debt collector who's actually collecting the money, but it doesn't matter. He can use the power of the government to arrest you anyway. So poor Marlon, and this makes me sick. He has to go out there and repair the house he can't live in. There's already people that came in there and they have all sorts of junk in there, homeless people, drug addicts, etc. But he has to go and repair the house. So he had to paint the house, he had to repair the steps. And this is the indignity, for whatever reason, really got under my skin. He has to go back and mow the lawn every week. Oh, for Christ's sake, but the bank doesn't even let him sell the house as you saw with the other case. And he says, well, I gotta get rid of this debt. I don't have this money. I didn't live in the house. They say, sad day, the banks don't have to tell you if they decide not to foreclose. And they're under no legal obligation. You're under all the legal obligations. Now, by the way, if you sold the money, the house for a profit, would you then get the profit? Nope, the bank would get it. So they get all the benefits, you get all of the costs. Gee, I wonder why people are frustrated with banks and our government for not being able to help us at all. So we continue. Cleveland Marshall College Law Professor Kermit Lynn had a really great line about this. He said, these people have become like indentured serfs with all the responsibilities for the properties, but none of the rights. He's exactly right. I mean, this is what they've done to us on a mass scale. We work for them. And in this, the indignity that you can't even live in the house, but you have to pay the bills, otherwise you're going to jail, is mind-numbing. So why do the banks do it? Well, here's the interesting part. They say banks can at least reap the insurance, the tax and accounting benefits for documenting the loss if they say, oh, the house is valueless. I can't sell this house. So I got rid of the guys that are in the house, but it's not worth anything. So I'm going to write it off as a loss. Then I get the tax benefits of it, and I claim it on insurance. If I sold the house, I couldn't do that because I'd get some money back. I couldn't get the insurance, and I wouldn't get as big a tax benefit. And on top of that, and the reason that they're kicking the people out of the house so they can play this trick on them is just to get a little extra money. They then sell the unpaid debt to debt collectors. And now there's even more unpaid debt because you didn't realize you were accruing penalties and fees because you didn't know you still own the house. So they turn over to debt collectors and they say, hound them forever and make sure they, or get whatever you want out of them because they already got the money from the debt collectors. This is cruelty beyond imagination, but it gets worse. There is actually no regulations that require the banks to let homeowners know that they have changed their mind about a foreclosure. Is the government working on that at all? Absolutely not. Now, here's Judge Patrick Carney of Buffalo, New York. He works at the housing court, and here's what he says. The banks do not answer inquiries. They do not answer phone calls. They do not answer letters. Sound like Dr. Seuss character. The whole situation is surreal, he said. Think about that. Not only do they tell you you're foreclosed, they padlock your house, they send you to the debt collectors, they possibly get you arrested, and then when you ask them, they don't answer any inquiries and they have a legal right not to. What then, what the hell are you supposed to do? Okay, it gets worse. Just when you think it can't get any worse. Well, then we go to the case of Joseph Keller. He's from Columbus, Ohio, and like all the rest of these cases, hardworking American, ran into some trouble during the recession. Couldn't afford to make the payments. Well, he says, okay. And the bank told him, you're foreclosed on, go home. Again, goes home to live with his kids in their tiny little room, can barely move around in there. Meanwhile, the whole house is sitting there empty. And again, people break into the house. Same story. So then he gets a letter from Chase's debt collector, Professional Recovery Services. And they say, at this time, we're able to offer you a settlement, oh, fantastic, of $25,258.41 on this account to be paid within 15 days. Well, are they not merciful? The guy doesn't have $25,000. He didn't even realize he owned the house. Again, you got to go back. You got to fix the house so you don't get more fines, etc. You got to mow the lawn. And by the way, he doesn't just owe them $25,000. He also owes the county $11,759.08. So basically, he owes close to $37,000, which he does not have, and he has to maintain the house, which he also does not have, but technically he owns. So what's the extra twist in this case? Well, turns out he's got significant liver disease. It's advanced, he's got hepatitis C and inactive tuberculosis. And he needs treatment from this, but it's a good thing because the Social Security Administration can give him disability benefits. But they just rejected those benefits because on the records, it shows that he still owns a house. The court says, we might be able to hear your case in December. Keller said, I will very likely be dead by then.
Is your blood boiling yet? Remember, we can't regulate banks because it would stifle financial innovation. Financial innovation like zombie titles.
As soon as you're born, they make you feel small by giving you no time instead of it all. Till the pain is so big you feel nothing at all. A working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be. They hurt you at home and they hit you at school. They hate you if you're clever and they despise a fool. Till you're so fucking crazy you can't follow their rules. A working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be. When they tortured and scared you for 20 odd years, then they expect you to pick a career. When you can't really function, you're so full of fear. A working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be. Keep you doped with religion and sex and TV. And you think you're so clever and classless and free. But you're still fucking peasants as far as I can see. A working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be. There's room at the top, they are telling you still. But first you must learn how to smile as you kill. You want to be like the folks on the hill. A working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be. If you want to be a hero, well, just follow me. If you want to be a hero, well, just follow me.
That's John Lennon, Working Class Hero. Seemed appropriate for after that last clip from the Young Turks. That's it for our show this week. I hope you'll be joining me again in 2 weeks. Remember, I'm now appearing fortnightly on WGXC every second and fourth Tuesday of the month at 10 a.m. I hope this hasn't put out my one or two regular listeners too much by switching to the morning on Tuesdays rather than Wednesday afternoons. Next time, I'll be covering the State of the Union address, which happened this past month, but I didn't get a chance to put it into this week's show. So in a couple of weeks, I'll be talking about that and the minimum wage, which featured in both the State of the Union and Governor Cuomo's proposal, and which has been a favorite target of many economists who like to blame it for all kinds of things like unemployment and poverty. Seems kind of counterintuitive, and I'll explain exactly why it's counterintuitive, as well as what their reasoning is when I talk about it next time. So until then, this is your friendly neighborhood economist, signing off. This has been your friendly neighborhood economist. I can be heard on the third Wednesday of every month or anytime online. Check me out on WGXC.org, on Facebook at Your Friendly Neighborhood Economist, on Twitter at YFNEconomist, or on Tumblr at YFNEconomist.tumblr.com. If you've got a question you've been dying to ask a sympathetic economist, send it to me through one of those venues or email me at YFNEconomist@gmail.com. Your Friendly Neighborhood Economist is brought to you by WGXC 90.7 FM Hudson Catskill ACRA and produced by Thomas Masterson. That's me. I'll talk to you next month.